Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and Daisha Eaton of KSKA. The Assembly puts off the airport land swap, and we have another major land use controversy here in Anchorage. Steve, you want to give us the update?
This involves Point Warrensov Park, which is southwest of the one of the runways of the airport, or southwest of the airport. And the airport wants this section of land. The problem is it's bisected by the Tony Knowles Coastal Trail. They want this land for future expansion. They may want to create another runway. They may want to put in a de-icing station. There's a couple of different reasons. They don't have any specific plans yet to tell the public, but this is something that they've had their eye on for several years now. This, by the way, this controversy first came up in 2008. What they want to do is trade two other parcels of land that are basically, it's parkland now. The airport owns it. They want to trade these two parcels of land along with a snow dump to the city in exchange for the rights and the ownership of Point Warrensov. But the folks who live in West Anchorage, and I think probably a good number of people who live across the city who frequent the Coastal Trail, are very upset about this because it would alter the Coastal Trail.
You reach a point where there'd be a fence that says do not enter?
Well, the airport says what they would do would be perhaps create a tunnel. We're talking about a little bit more than a half mile stretch of the trail, and they would put a tunnel and you would go through this tunnel. Now, there's a couple of tunnels already on the Coastal
Trail.
Not
a half mile long.
Not a half mile long, though, no. They're just like maybe 40 feet or so, 50 feet or so, but this would be about a half mile through this tunnel. And this has folks upset. They feel that it's time to make a statement about quality of life and what parkland's going to be and what the city's going to use parkland for.
Many people come out there for the view, and the view is not the site of a tunnel.
Right. And this is kind of, if you listen to folks in West Anchorage and supporters of the Coastal Trail, and I've been on that trail many, many times, they say that Point Warrensov Park is sort of the crown jewel of that trail,
right,
because
right,
it offers ocean views, and it's a wonderfully wooded area. You run into a lot of moose and other kind of wildlife that's out there, and it is a beautiful stretch there. And so this is the Assembly was going to, it took public testimony. It was going to vote on the matter Tuesday night, decided we need to postpone this to September when more folks are available, because a lot of Alaskans are outside playing right now.
Daisha, you did a story on this issue. Tell us more.
Well, during the public testimony, one gentleman reportedly got up and said that he had documents that could change the whole situation. He said that there was a deed that basically specified that the Warrensov Park couldn't be used for anything else but public use. Now, it could get tricky with the airport defining what public use means, but it seemed more on the side of recreational activity. So those documents have been turned over to Ernie Hall and some other Assembly members, and they're reviewing them. They've gone to the municipal attorney, and we'll see what they say about them.
Yeah, it's not an easy question to settle for the Assembly either. You're looking at a major economic engine. 1 in 10 jobs that the city has is generated by the airport. Airports are competitive by nature,
right,
as well.
Right,
just the very reason why we have the cargo industry that we have here in Anchorage is because of upgrades made to the airport and a sales job that the city did and the state did. So there's a lot at stake here. Maybe not right now, but maybe 10, 15, 20 years down the line, there could be some tough decisions.
And did I understand you, Steve, correctly, that we won't be hearing more about this till the fall?
September. Assembly Chair Hall decided that, I think it was Debbie Osiander who made the suggestion. Assemblywoman Debbie Osiander just felt that, the weather's nice, people are outside right now, not a lot of folks are paying attention to this.
They're walking the trail.
They're walking the trail. Although there was a pretty good crowd of folks who were there in the Assembly chambers, she just felt that it won't be on anybody's radar screen until the fall when the weather starts to change. And she just felt that there would be a better representation of people at that particular point of time in the year. So probably a good choice, I think.
Okay, Desha, the Environmental Protection Agency hears from Alaskans on the subject of the Pebble Mine. What Alaskans have to say?
Well, just about 1,000 people, probably 1,000 people or more, showed up at the Wendy
Williams. That's quite a turnout.
Yes, it was quite a turnout, and people on both sides of the issue, it's really people against the Pebble Mine and for the Pebble Mine, showed up. And, you know, they were supposed to be commenting on the EPA's preliminary report draft Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. But mostly they were talking about how they felt, and people are clearly very passionate on both sides of this. There wasn't a whole lot of comment on the document itself. People got 2 minutes each to comment, and 140 people commented. All those comments were being recorded, and they're going to incorporate them into the watershed assessment. And they also announced at that event that they have appointed a panel of scientists to review, you know, what's going on with Pebble and all the science involved, and they'll have a report out soon, and late in the year, and then there should be a final report with all the public comments and all the scientific analysis by the end of the year.
I did some quick elementary math. That's 4 hours of public testimony at 2 hours or 2 minutes a clip.
Yes.
And the recipients of this were who? Who was sitting at the table?
There were several people from the EPA were there. Dennis McLaren was the main person who was listening.
Local and regional officials?
Yes, from the Region 10 EPA office in Seattle.
Okay, and what happens next?
What happens next is, well, all this week they were out in Bristol Bay and out in the villages collecting public comment there. They'll incorporate that into this draft Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. The scientific panel is now taking suggested questions that people would like answered through their assessment, so you can submit those through the EPA website. And that's for, you know, a little less than 30 days now. And then they'll go into the period where they'll write their scientific assessment. And by the end of the year, they said in the fall this watershed assessment would be done, but it looks like it's going to be a little closer to the end of the year. Mm. And, you know, we could see the Pebble Partnership and all the entities involved begin applying for permits soon. So it's moving right along.
Final question. With these hundreds of people who turned out and testified, I don't know if you were keeping score, but could you give us a general sense of which way the people who chose to testify were leaning?
I'd say the majority of people who showed up were passionately against the development of Pebble Mine. I don't know if that's because that was a hearing held here in Anchorage, and a lot of the activist groups who are working to stop the mine are here. There were also some business people. There were a lot of people wearing little cutout hands on their jackets that said, "Hands off Alaska." This is a group that, you know, doesn't want federal involvement.
Symbolic communication, right? I guess.
Yes, exactly. But I'd say most people were talking passionately against the mine.
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald, Jill Burke, and Desha Eaton. Jill, you have been attending the Alaska Militiamen trial at the federal courthouse in Anchorage, as have I. This was a busy week, as we heard from two of the three defendants, and the trial continues next week. There's a lot to talk about here, but what are, for the audience, people who haven't been able to go to the trial, what are some of the major things we can tell them?
I think that, certainly Schaefer Cox, who's the accused militia leader, kind of the ringleader of the group, taking the stand was very significant, as was his, close associate Coleman Barney. They both spoke finally after weeks of this trial in which everybody else has been speaking for them, and kind of prosecutors characterizing these guys as being sovereign citizen extremists who had a violent anti-government plan, had taken steps to carry it out, and needed to be stopped. Cox was on the stand for, I think, almost 2 days, maybe a little bit more than 2 days, and was classic Cox. He was a very large personality. He made eye contact all around the room, looked at jurors. He was at times pleasant, at times he was a little low and emotional when he was either thinking about maybe his wife or at one point hearing his young son's voice on one of the secret videotapes or audio tapes that had been made by the FBI. He was also fairly defiant, I would say, in dealing with prosecutors anyway. When it came time for cross-examination, you kind of get the sense that he's someone who likes to be in control. He likes to be the one who is the information bearer and be the one who's going to show everybody how to arrive at his point of view or his conclusions. And I think that the frustration of not being the one in control of that narrative and having to try to get your truth out or your story out in these halted kind of snippets that is the style of being a witness in
and
a courtroom
if I might
proceeding.
The judge reminding Mr. Cox and some degree Barney, but mostly Cox, this is a yes and no, or this is a question and answer
right.
show, not a narrative show.
Short, short answers, answer the question, don't elaborate. And Cox had to be reminded of this many, many times. And, you know, in terms of just following courtroom procedures, Cox is in the witness stand. He's the one who's being asked questions. He's the one who needs to answer. But he would at times just try to address the judge and ask questions. And the judge, who's a little bit hard of hearing, would look around the room and be like, who's talking? Who's talking? And Schaefer Cox would say, over here, judge, over here. And may I ask a question? And he, again, the judge was like, not now. You'll have to wait for another time for that. So I think, you know, Cox, there's so much this week. I think one of the important things from Cox is we've heard so much about his speeches, and we've heard him in his public speeches, and we've heard these secret audio recordings where they're talking about violent resistance. They're talking about killing law enforcement. They're talking about the possibility of killing or arresting judges. They're talking about defending Cox in the event somebody comes at him with guns blazing. And his political rhetoric that is very much laced with violent imagery is very brazen and very bold and very direct. And he said it frequently and he said it often and he said it to anybody who would listen. Cox got up on the stand and said, look, yeah, I have that style. I'm a provocateur. I'm like Glenn Beck. I'm like Howard Stern. I like to say things in their extremes to shock people out of their mindset and bring them over to a different way of thinking. And he really tried to characterize this whole mess as an intellectual exercise, just inquiry, and maybe some exercises to help spurn that inquiry. The common law court, serving the court system with paperwork that was kind of, you know, declaring that they didn't have jurisdiction over Cox and other kinds of bizarre things.
There was some really, I thought, unusual things. One was when Nelson Traverso, who is Cox's lawyer, was questioning Cox, mm-hmm. and he did it in a very, I wouldn't say he wasn't yelling, but it was a loud, forceful voice in which he was saying to his own client several times, answer the question.
Right. Well, and I think that goes to show maybe some of Cox's unwillingness to engage with the rules of the court the way that the court needs them to be followed. And Traverso needs Cox, his client, in order to do his service to his client, to just answer the questions so they can get their story out in a way that will be acceptable to the court.
And Traverso and Cox were trying to establish that there was a very real, credible threat to his life through Bill Fulton and perhaps the federal government, and also these federal agents, and they between them, Cox and Traverso, got out there a whole bunch of information about what Cox had heard about threats to his life.
Right, and so this image emerges of, you know, you kind of have these different things that are putting pressures on Cox. One is his own pressure, his own desire for kind of the celebrity and the influence of someone who's got people's attention and can say things that are shocking and maybe spurn some kind of reform on social systems, cultural systems, political systems. But then you also have this like inner life of Cox where he believes, because he's been so successful in his reform agenda, that people are out to quiet him. The government wants him silenced, and that perhaps maybe they even want him killed. And he starts assembling this kind of you know, these examples of ways in which this might be true. And there's one example after another after another. And he, you kind of get this image of someone who is growing increasingly fearful, increasingly paranoid, increasingly convinced that there is a real threat out there to himself, and taking steps to either defend his family if it happens or avoid it if it should happen. I want to point one other thing out from Cox, and then I'll let you chime in here, is that I think that for all of Cox's discussion about how his rhetoric, how his talk was not intended to actually carry out violent action, and that how all of his exercises were somehow insignificant. I think he said in court, you know, I held my common law court at Denny's. We didn't think anybody would take a court held at Denny's seriously.
I believe the word he used was hokey.
Hokey, right, yes, he did use hokey. I think to some extent that's disingenuous because, you know, it's one thing if Cox believed that, but he got other people on board with his plan. He got other people to go to the trial at Denny's and sign their names to documents, and he got other people to serve the courts with the paperwork, and he, there wasn't evidence that he ever told any of these people, we're going to go through this big exercise, but really it's just, you know, it's just an exercise.
Some of them were Coleman Barney's parents who were sitting in the audience.
Right. Yes. Yes. So, I don't mean to be, you know, disrespectful of individuals who may have been there with Cox for this common law court, because I do think that people are curious about the Constitution, and they do believe that the government is off track, and they want to know, well, maybe is there some way to get it back on track, and perhaps this is an outlet for it. That's one of the descriptions of what's taking place that we've heard from Cox.
And if I might, that would suggest that Cox was using these people for his purposes and not explaining to them what his purposes were.
That's correct, and we heard that defense from Coleman Barney when Coleman Barney had a chance to talk, and we have heard this suggested to some extent by prosecutors, that this was really this kind of narcissistic agenda of Cox's to employ people around him who would work in service to him, who may not be totally aware of everything that he had going on. And a third pressure on Cox was his idea, they now believe, that the informants really pushed these plans, that the informants were the ones agitating, that the informants were the ones exacerbating the fears, that the informants were saying, look, what if a Ruby Ridge happens? What if that happens? What are you going to do? How are we going to stop that? How are we going to keep your wife and kids safe? What are you going to do? We need a plan. We need a plan. And, you know, I think that echoed true to some extent. We, you know, we hear this in the surveillance tapes. I don't have a good sense yet for where the jury's minds might be. I don't know if you do or what you're thinking.
Well, we'll see next week, and probably, in fact, I'm sure the instructions to the jury that the judge gives are going to be very, very important. And I know Traverso, I heard him talking about, you know, wanting a strong First Amendment privilege written into the instructions to the jury, so that's going to be important. Two things real quickly, and then we'll get on to something more. There was a very unusual moment Thursday when federal U.S. attorney in Fairbanks, Steve Cooper, testified for the defense. He was under subpoena. I talked to Cooper afterwards. This is the first time he'd ever been called to testify in a trial as a U.S. prosecutor. Mostly he was there to, the defense wanted to him to establish that he'd met with Cox, and there was a patina of, that's a poor word, there was definite respectability in Cox, and he was willing to meet with him. That wasn't explicit in the discussion, but it was definitely there, and also that Cox had felt threatened, and really what Cooper said was he seemed to be concerned about something, but it wasn't clear what he was concerned about. The other thing I thought was really quite amazing in the testimony of Coleman Barney, and Tim Dooley was doing it, and he played a lot of videotapes so that we could see from his perspective, I think, how rotten the informants were. That was largely what they were trying to establish. He was asked, would you buy an illegal firearm if you knew these were the end times, and Mr. Barney said no. And I just thought, you know, first of all, you know, sort of from the point of view of the law, if you're talking about objecting because a question is speculative, that would be it.
That's the time.
But this is, you know, the end times comes up every once in a while, just like Denny's comes up every once in a while. The latter days come up every once in a while. I thought this was really unusual that you would ask somebody this and they would answer it and presumably would help you. I guess the purpose of that was to establish that he wouldn't buy an illegal firearm in any circumstance.
And I do, if I can interject
one more time.
So one thing that's been a little bit confusing, I think, for people who are outside the courtroom is what are these charges really? Are we talking about, are they accused with some crime related to the speeches that Cox has made and the things he was saying, or are they accused in some other way? And prosecutors have been very clear, these are weapons crimes. They're not accused of speech crimes. They're accused of a slew of weapons violations for having unregistered, explosive devices, the launchers with maybe the canisters that shoot out of them, the rubber bullets.
I'm going to continue the tennis game just one more time, if you don't mind.
Sure.
And that is, these matters, the questions of the weapons, are establishable as true or false. Either you own these weapons legally or
you
didn't.
It doesn't matter what you were thinking. You had them or you didn't. And so you've got straightforward weapons crimes, then you've got the murder conspiracy, and then you have this third kind of set of crimes, which are weapons crimes that flow from the conspiracy. Possession of a weapon, a legal weapon, it doesn't have to be an illegal weapon, in furtherance of a crime of violence, which would be planning the murder conspiracy. And so, I think that the murder conspiracy is the one that they're really trying hard to strip, the defense is trying to strip down and convince juries just wasn't there, that it didn't exist. It was a plan to defend Schaefer Cox, but it wasn't a plan to offensively go out and kill people.
I'm trying to show that the 241 plan was a muddle.
Right, but then there's these other charges, like possession of a machine gun, unregistered machine gun, which Cox has admitted he made a machine gun, he had one, and it's not legal, at least not from what we've seen in court thus far. So I think some of these charges may be hard for these defendants to beat.
Okay, we need to move on here. We got about 4.5 minutes. Steve, a school secretary embezzles $100,000. How does this happen in modern Anchorage where we have modern accounting practices? Or maybe we don't.
Well, the school district says it does now. It was an audit that turned things up. Gail White, a woman who lives in Wasilla, worked at East High School for about 3 years. She's accused of embezzling student fees to the tune of about $100,000. Prior to that, or I think it was just after that, I should say, she was also working as a secretary at Chugiak High School, and she's suspected there of doing very similar work and coming away with some money as well. She was fired from that job. This is the fourth person now that Anchorage School District employee that's been fired in the last couple of years, suspected of embezzling money from the school district. District says it's changed its accounting plans. It's the way it supervises bringing its funds and things like that. And hopefully
we'll see what happens next.
Cut down on that.
Okay, we don't want to pass this. Welcome to Alaska's worst-dressed city, Anchorage. Not only Alaska's worst-dressed city, America's worst-dressed city, at least according to Travel and Leisure magazine. Say it ain't so. Let's start with you, Daisha, here. What can you tell us from the fashion perspective about Anchorage?
Well, I'm new to Anchorage, and I have to say there is a unique sense of style here. It's very practical, and I understand that it has a lot to do with the weather and people's lifestyle choices. However, I would draw the line at wearing your pajamas in public.
For example, people who shop in Costco wearing pajamas.
Yes. And so you do see some of that here. But I think they were pointing out a lot of layering and boots and Carhartts and practical things that people wear here because they're actually doing activities where they may need those, items of clothing.
Wedding dresses with extra tough boots. Yeah. I have attended weddings like this, and I have been seen weddings like this. If you're out on a bog with a beautiful beach backdrop, you need your extra tough.
On the other hand, in the wintertime, we do find people, I've seen them in the ditch, who are wearing sandals, shorts, and a t-shirt that has a message on it. And they're stuck in a snowbank. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's inappropriate attire, too.
I think we were speaking earlier, you made a great comment that your observation was it seems to be a fashion of convenience. We really, Alaskans, enjoy our lifestyle here. Mm-hmm. We like being able to ride our bikes to work. We like being able to hop in the car and kind of have this casual, semi-casual mode of dress to go to anything we want to, whether it's Costco or maybe a nice dinner
and
out.
And Jill,
the
how
theater.
Did Craig Medred of the Alaska Dispatch wind up as our new Mr. Blackwell?
I have no idea. That maybe fashion. That should be another poll that Travel and Leisure does. You know, he's an armchair critic for everything, but he made some good points that there are polls for everything.
Yeah.
You know,
Steve,
there was
you want to, as the man here who's wearing a tie beside myself, you want anything about bad dress in Anchorage?
Well, I just, that I contribute to it as often as I can, for one. The other
thing.
Well,
you did get rid of that purple hair.
Yeah. The other thing, a lot of it too is just survival. You know, one of the things that they talked to a woman who was a paleoclimatologist who'd come to Anchorage for the better part of 2 years doing some research. And she said she noted that everybody wore bunny boots and big parkas and layered up and stuff. Obviously, she came here in the winter. I'd like to know what she was wearing when she came here because she probably wasn't a cardigan sweater. But, you do it out of survival. It's called freezing.
On the other hand, go ahead.
Medred also pointed out, he said, you know, at least we're not all nude.
Yeah.
There's a saving.
There's a reason for that. I have seen at the Social Security office people who come to ask the federal government for money. They have their hat on backwards, their baseball hat on backwards, and raggy jeans and a T-shirt that says, I heart Jack Daniels. So on that note, we will part and enjoy the rest of the evening. See you next week. I said evening.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.